have I just discovered or read that he left 8 tons of documents, the Sound Museum, 8 tons, published 142 books, and copies of 250,000 letters that he wrote on the subject to various people all over the world. Can you tell me, is there lots of scholarship and writing and books being written so that all this stuff can be used?
Alas, in the brief time I had to prepare this talk, I did try to make inquiries at all kinds of places. It seems that nothing is surviving. The books, there were a large number of books written when he died and before he died in America, mainly in America, and they're all out of print, every single one of them. And alas, when I went to do this talk, and I recently, fairly recently moved home and went to find my other books, I've managed to lose the books it took me years to find, including King Cole and Oil. I'm hoping they'll turn up. Alas, the only way to find anything is by hunting around second-hand bookshops. And I did that as well in the brief time I had. And the story was the same. They come in and they go out straight away. You would think, and I think probably, the same thing may happen with him as happened with Huxley. Now there's Huxley's all being reissued again because a certain time has passed and it's an anniversary. And I think the same thing will happen with that. I cannot believe that these books will be lost. I cannot believe that nobody should allow them to be lost. I mean, this was last published in 1985, and the edition I had before that, which I gave away last week to someone, was 1970-something, and that didn't even have a preface or a foreword or anything. It's just published straight like that. I had a wonderful edition before that in hardback, which I've lost with a wonderful preface. But no, they have all these documents, but it's happened to so many people. Upton Sinclair was such a prolific writer. I mean, when he was 17, with these damn serials, he reckoned he had written more than some of the novelists in their whole lifetime, you know. And he turned it out all the time writing, and of course he eventually published at his own expense, at his own publishing house. And that was there. He wrote letters. He had correspondences. I remember he wrote one letter to William Saroyan. And where do these letters go? See, and he sent him a copy of his book called The Cup of Fury. I think he thought, oh, it was on the booze. And he said, and William Savoyan recalls this, I don't know why he sent me this book, he said. But he said, I have to tell you this. He said, I'm not a voting man, but if there was ever a time I did vote, it would only be for him. And he wrote hundreds of letters. He had hundreds of friends. And where have those gone? You know, I've got in this modern, if you look in this latest edition, you'll find a whole list of books. You go and try and get any of them. They're probably in the libraries. They're probably in the British Library. They're probably in some libraries in New York, but trying to actually get a book to own. Let's see, 43, 55, 65. One here, 75. A certain can even get that. 60, 68. That was the time all the books were written on him, at the time of his death, really.
Could you... Going back to publishing, is that the British publishing scene or is that the American publishing scene?
No, you don't.
I have a feeling that you wouldn't have to go too hard to get the jungle. And in the series The Depression in America, there was a whole programme done on Upton Sinclair. And I went into a Remainder book shop a couple of years ago where they were selling old America, you know, American. And there was a paper, there was a huge paperback of Boston, but it was retitled The Sacco and Vanzetti Trial. I mean, they're not complete. I've never read King Cole, but I don't think you'd have too much of a trouble to get through it for a library.
Well, I wouldn't be too sure about that.
I'll try and come back to you later.
Yeah. I was thinking about you when you were reading about the cold and the rats. When I was first working here in London, Market Square, actually, we were so cold in our office, trying to type, we had to sit with our typewriter covers around our feet. Not so long ago, and the mice came out and played around.
Yeah, well, you were very lucky. Your fingers weren't frozen to the feet.
Oh yes, but I can imagine the cold.
Well, the mice would have had a nibble as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, in one part of the book, one of the children does get killed by being eaten by rats.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good read.
I was just wondering what Richard could tell us about Sinclair and what he thought of Roosevelt and the New Deal.
But of course he felt betrayed by Roosevelt, I mean, eventually. But of course he did support, as so many others did, got lured into the stupidity of the First World War, and like so many other so-called socialists. I mean, he had high hopes of Roosevelt at one time, Sinclair, there's no question about that. But there's no question either that ultimately he saw himself as betrayed, even though as late as whenever it was, 1930, whatever it was, he did accept the democratic nomination. He had hopes of all those things, but eventually, as I said, in one of his books he suggested that Randolph Hearst would take over from Roosevelt and bring in the new socialist millennium. Well, you know, he wasn't very good on his judgments, and he was very trusting of people he met if they weren't connected with the beef, oil, or money industry. I think that the problem that Upton Sinclair had is that he had the naivety of a truly good man, and I think he was deceived all along his life by many people with whom he put a lot of hope, and Theodore Roosevelt was one of them.
I mean, Franklin Delano.
Oh, that one. Oh, well, worse. Worse for him, but for that was even worse because, oh, sorry, I thought you were talking about Theodore. He was felt let down by Theodore.
The New Deal.
Oh, yes. Oh, he also felt betrayed by the New Deal. Although he saw hopes, it's interesting, again, the extract I read here where he saw the hope was in the British Labour Party, eventually, not in America. By the end of his life, he felt that everything had been betrayed, that the New Deal had been betrayed. And, of course, he wasn't alone. Everybody radical in America soon saw through Franklin Roosevelt's sham. But I think, you know, it's amazing to me that by the end of his life he remained optimistic and that he wasn't disillusioned by the people he was let down by time and time again. And he still went to see people like Johnson, although he had no truck with them, really. I think every now and again he had hopes, and every now and again throughout the whole spectrum of American politics his hopes would rise and he'd think, well, here's another chance. But deep down, I think, and I think he showed it when he was supported the First World War, he still wrote anti-war books and he still wrote about heroes who were doing double things. And I think that deep down he really must have known. But he had this strange trait that he seemed to clutch to any optimistic straw. But I think there's no question about it. I don't know if he's recorded his thoughts about it, but I'm damn sure that he would say, well, I'm sure he has read them, I'm sure I've read them somewhere, that he felt betrayed. Utterly betrayed by Roosevelt and then Roosevelt.
Coming back then.
I was wondering, could you make any comparisons or similarities or parallels with a writer like Steinbeck, who was more or less writing? And would I be right in saying he was more?
Yes, well, of course.
And were there any connections at all between the two of them on a personal or other level?
Well, I can't imagine there wouldn't have been connections between Steinbeck and Upton Sinclair. And of course, there were similarities in some of the passages at the end of The Jungle, for instance. It's very similar in a way to the ending of Grapes of Wrath. Chicago will be ours, Chicago will be ours. And very, very similar indeed to the ending of The Grapes of Wrath. And of course, in many ways, it's a similar tale. The great strength, I believe, of Upton Sinclair's book, that it doesn't write about people living in the country going on to get jobs that they know they'll be swindled probably in desperation. He writes about people coming filled with hope, with no prejudice, nothing but wonder and awe, and then bit by bit, page by page, because I read it all in quick extracts, but it takes a long time for that disillusionment and the steel heel to come down on his mind. And yes, there was certainly similarity, but of course Steinbeck wrote many wonderfully funny books, and wonderfully life-enhancing funny books as well. And, for instance, Cannery Row was a wonderful book, and many others. And I think that Sinclair could never really allow himself to do that. In everything he wrote, there was, except his book about the Civil War, there was a bit of propaganda and a bit of pamphleteering. And in that way, Steinbeck was probably cleverer in that way. And perhaps maybe that's a criticism of Upton Sinclair, but not in my book, it isn't, because it wasn't through The Grapes of Wrath, which I read this first, and this was the thing that made me angry, and made me angry in a way even Grapes of Wrath couldn't make me angry.
The socialist group that Eugius joins at the end of the book seem to be as confused as Upton Sinclair, because they seem to think that there's going to be some kind of wages system in the socialist future.
Hey?
They talk about wages, they talk about state control. One of them is religious, and he thinks that it can be reconciled with the anti-religious beliefs of some of the others. They seem to be quite a mixture.
Just let me see if I can find a bit for you. Well,
yeah.
Of course, you must understand that that in Sinclair's own life, he was greatly, one of the people who turned him into socialism was a Congregational minister.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he was a sort of religious socialist. There's still a lot of them about.
Yeah.
He had a lot of, he often talks about soul in his writing and things like this.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's diminished for that, but I'm not quite so sure. If somebody else is thinking of a question, I'll just try and find a passage that might help to answer that question.
Or answer
there's, it. There's a chapter where they have a long discussion, and
yes,
there's a great mixture of...
a great mixture of point of view.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting, because it reminded me of our summer school. Because the bloke in that, you remember, one of the onlookers said, well, what's all this? I thought they were all the same, and here they are, arguing like fleas in a pit. What's going on? They've all got different thoughts. But then he said, doesn't he, what unites them? Remember that? And he gives two answers, and they're answers that I don't think we would disagree with. And in fact, I think they're two of our four fundamental principles. I'll just try and find them for you. I can. If then somebody else wants to ask a question, well, I'm just looking for this because it wasn't the passage I picked out.
You didn't read the Socialist Party of America, was it?
Yes, yeah, Socialist Party of America.
How would you know what the question is?
It comes a bit later on, I know where it is.
Well, that's a question. Where's your question?
Very well.
Well, of course, they were different
reformist organisation, so I mean, you wouldn't expect it to be 100%.
It was when he was arguing with Dr. Schielman, the Swede, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And they were, and he was arguing with this religious man who wanted to keep religion and his socialism. And then it's here; it's coming now. I just wanted to find the tough. Forgot what the actual 2 points were, but some we can go on. Perhaps you can find it. It's around page 408. Have you got the same edition?
Yes. Yeah. Well,
he asks him, he says, what unites you in your position? When he tells them they've been arguing like that. Anyway, right, all right then.
All right, okay, that's over. Next question, next subject. Okay, looks like we want to break the tea then.
Did he write plays before?
I don't think of that. I don't. Oh, yes, he did write plays, as a matter of fact. He did write plays, because I remember another thing that William Saroyan said. He was, in fact, that's why he sent him the Cup of Fury, because they had heard that he was going around New York saying, there's only one play to see here. Go and see it. And
some of his novels were dramatised as well. I don't know if
I don't know if he did it all himself. Governor and got smashed or something. I haven't read that, I must confess. But I know about that. Schielman was the philosophic anarchist, wasn't he? And Lucas the religious zealot. Here we are. On what? Yeah. Oh, yes.
You see, there's this passage, page 404. Cooperative Commonwealth is a universal automatic insurance company and savings bank for all its members.
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
Capital being the property of all, injury to it is shared by all and made up by all. The bank is the universal government credit account.
Yes.
The ledger in which every individual's earnings and spendings are balanced. There is also a universal government bulletin, in which are listed and precisely described everything which the Commonwealth has for sale. As no one makes any profit by the sale, there is no longer any stimulus to extravagance and no misrepresentation. No cheating, no adulteration or imitation, no bribery or graft.
Yes.
How is the price of an article determined? The price is the labour it has cost to make and deliver it, and is determined by the first principles of arithmetic. The million workers in the nation's wheat fields have worked 100 days each, and the total product of the labour is 1 billion bushels. So the value of a bushel of wheat is the tenth part of a farm labour day.
Yes. But there are other passages in the book, particularly of the orator who he first hears, in which he lays down principles which are far removed from that.
Yeah.
The point was they did come with different arguments, and here it is. Would the two, for his enlightenment, try to ascertain just what they had in common and why they belong to the same party? This resulted, after much debating, in the formulating of two carefully worded propositions. First, that a socialist believes in the common ownership and democratic management of the means of producing the necessities of life, and second, that a socialist believes the means by which this is brought about is by the class-conscious political organisation of wage earners. Well, those are two pretty good principles.
Before you turn the page, I was going to say, tell me the number of the page.
Oh, sorry. Oh, bloody hell, I've lost it again.
No, I just put up to the chair, but I'll find it. I was being very...
Around 400 names.
But in their first orator, the stuff in that was very sound. There was none of that about wage earning in that. He was talking about all kinds of other things. So, of course, I mean, but they were different people coming from different walks of life, and the concept of getting rid of wages for most of them was, you know...
Quite far out.
Quite far out, but not for all of them, by any means.
Well, first of all, I think it's very important to consider the function of a novelist is not to be a political philosopher. Novelists are far better at impressionistic account of what life is like. And political philosophers are not traditionally very good at communicating that sort of thing. So I think that's what a novelist was. The refugee philanthropist wasn't very good when it came to the practicalities of what a socialist society might be like, in that it talked about a very highly centralised and statist alternative. I don't think that's the issue. I don't think that's why people didn't do it. I don't think that's why anybody didn't do it. It's not the significant fact. The other point about the abolition of the wages system is it's very important to remember when this book was written. It was published 1 year before the formation of the industrial workers of the world. And in which city was the industrial workers of the world formed? Commonly known as the Wobblers Internet, because it was called the IWW, and a lot of the Chinese immigrant labourers in Chicago used to refer to it as the I Wobble Wobble. And that's why they were called the Wobblers. It wasn't that funny, just historically true. And the point about it is that the Wobblers were formed in 1905, a year later, in Chicago. And there was clearly, that was the centre of the class struggle in America, of the political class struggle in America at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, for example, the only Marxist publishing house in the whole of the world was based in Chicago in that year. Charles H. Kern, they're still there in Chicago. The greatest philosopher in the history of the socialist movement was buried there, and in fact was the person who had great influence still in Chicago in the 20th century. Joseph Dietzky. And so for all of these reasons, this wasn't being written in a vacuum. It was being written in the context of a sharpening awareness that the abolition of wage labour was a practical possibility. And while some people might want to rubbish the Socialist Party of America, and personally, I don't see any point in that kind of sectarian reading of history. I think you have to read history in terms of where people were and how far they got, not what they should have said. So I think if you read history, and even worse, if you read novels in that fashion, you absolutely glue yourself to the value of what you're seeing. Now, as it happens, IWW was only formed as a result of the most magnificent coalition of forces in American history. The Socialist Labour Party, which was the most orthodoxly Marxist party, in my view, in America at the time, of any significance. I say that because I know there was a companion party of the FDGB in America at the time, but it was of no significance numerically or in terms of impact. The Socialist Labour Party threw itself into the formation of the IWW in 1905 and committed itself to support for the manifesto, which advocated the abolition of wage labour. And the Socialist Party of America, in the main, supported the IWW, and its leader, the man who incidentally went on to get the largest number of votes ever in any presidential election in the States, Eugene Debs. Although Norman Thomas actually got a larger number of votes in the 1932 presidential election, proportionately got a smaller number in relation to the entire population, that's by the bar. Depth was present at these in Chicago in 1905 for the formation of the Industrial Revolution. And if you read the minutes of the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World, this is my climax now of historical analysis, who was present at that first meeting of the Industrial Workers of the World? Upton Sinclair. So I don't know whether Upton Sinclair was, you know, betraying anything when he pointed out that there was great division and disagreement and argument within the socialist movement. He was only telling the truth. He was pointing out the way it was, particularly in America, in a country where you had a variety. I mean, in the Midwest, you had a lot of workers who were very committed to serious socialist ideas. On the East Coast, you had a lot of people who'd come over from Europe with a ragbag of various social democratic ideas. From Germany, for example, and some of them from Scandinavia, whatever. Over on the West Coast, in California, you had people who were, you know, the so-called hobos, the people who were advocating a kind of, a very violent form of anarchism, you know, throwing bombs at the bosses and so on, and all that kind of thing. Now, the fact is, there was a huge division. You know, it wasn't a united, simple thing. So I think one has to actually look at this in the historical context of when it was written to understand it.
Incidentally, one of the things I didn't touch on really in my talk was the way in which you were treated when you joined the union in those days. I mean, they put spies into the unions and sacked the people who were in the unions and called the strikes, although gradually the unions did. But certainly unions themselves were corrupt, viciously corrupt. Pretended to represent the interests of the workers, and they didn't. That's why the new movement was growing in such strength, and why they wanted to get into the unions and change them. And of course, it's interesting that it's right, that feeling of socialist change, it was in every country in the world practically, there was this feeling going on. It must have been a very exciting time that fired people with that sort of, and you can understand that optimism, even though it was betrayed.
The IWW are still an effective organisation?
No.
In 1964, when they published their thumb book, they stated that their objective was to be able to blow the whistle and get a capitalist touch right on the production line. And the only organisation that could really do it was the IWW. And in this book, to add emphasis to it, they put it in twice. Their objective is to get the capitalist class doing exactly what the working class. And it seemed a bit peculiar to say that it was a revolutionary organisation that wanted to make the capitalist class into a working class. I mean, and that was published in 1964.
Well,
that's good for being
put that way.
When I left home this morning, I happened to read it. I should have brought the book to show you, but I thought it was healthy, not very social. So I don't think it was really...
Well, it certainly was a concept that many people in this book had, where they wanted to see those buggers who were cheating and doing what they were doing. It was a very human response. May not have been a very sound socialist response, but it was a bloody human response.
I think what we've been talking about
over the last couple of contributions is what we've been referring to is essentially a tremendous shift throughout the 20th century in terms of political class attitudes. And it's interesting, I think, to think about why this shift happened, what the difference is between so the early part of the century and now. What we've got now and where do we go from here? There seem to be questions that arise from Richard's talk about Upton Sinclair. I've read these books a very long time ago, like it. And they were given to you, you know, when I was a young person around the Socialist Party. You
were expected certainly to read the general, and the other one I read was the one that Richard talked about, or referred to, oil. So those were two books that I read. And I think they were, I mean, they everybody in the Socialist Party of Britain. And I don't think they were admired for the brilliance of their political analysis. But what they did in it was to sort of confirm your hatred for the system. And it laid before you all the reasons why capitalism was essentially a system.
Mm.
So, and what it also did was to sort of confirm your feeling of class solidarity. And those are why they're really great books, like Steve mentioned that kind of reading. But when Richard said in his description of Upton Sinclair that he was an optimist, but a naive man who was let down by people who trust him. In a sense, that's an epitaph for age as well. Because all the class feeling that was part of that move in the early part of the century did eventually get dissipated. I think it's largely gone now. And one of the reasons why it was gone is because it found its political expression in things like social democratic parties, the Labour parties, and what have you, who ran into, who had all sorts of misconceived ideas about what they could actually do in that case when they formed governments. And it all founded on that place of error, eventually. And this whole mood and feeling of class solidarity has become dissipated, it's become global. And what you've really got now, I'd like to suggest, is really, we might be reluctant to admit it, but what we've really got in the minds of most individuals now is the triumph of something quite opposite, the triumph of economic individualism. And this, it is the values associated with that and the objectives and drives associated with that which drive most people, including workers, now.
There is a passage.
I'm not absolutely sure about it. But if it's true, you know, what does it mean for the socialist movement? And where do we go from here if that is true?
Well, there is a part in the book where he actually does deal for a time with the concept of economic individualism, and rather is very disparaging about it indeed. And it is ironic, isn't it, that although also he puts in the mouths of his great orator the clear concept that socialism can't happen in one place, yet he came to see that the Labour Party in England was perhaps the beginning of a new dawn. And I think that feeling of individual, you see, in a sense, what's happened in society, we have gone through this, we have become brutalised, there's no question about it, in a much more subtle way than they were brutalised in this book. The people here were brutalised by sheer fear and terror and misery, but we have become brutalised and put the steel of our heel in our minds in other ways. And in a way, I think what has happened in society is that the reaction as a society, how we are seeing this manifested, is in the same way as those sensitivities were stamped out of the mind of Jurgis in the book. So that's happened so worldwide that everything is mass and loud and images take the place of reality and escape and it's driving people away. If you can survive as a single man, you can survive. That was Thatcher's message, for God's sake, if you don't think about anybody else. And that's the conclusion that Jurgis came to. I believe all these things are phase. I believe there are positive aspects too. I believe we are, as the working class is now much more aware of these tricks, thanks to people like Upton Sinclair and others. And though it may be stamped out of them from now and again, it seems, it never goes away. And I think there are more people today in society, despite what I just said, who when they go to bed at night do think about the things that affect them and wonder why it happens and wonder why people are starving, wonder why they can't get a hospital bed. And these things are So we are many, in many ways, there is grounds for optimism, because at the same time as this is happening, and what wasn't happening in Upton Sinclair's time, is that the capitalist system itself is in a more dire hole now than it ever was in Upton Sinclair's time. There are endless markets. There are endless areas to exploit. They're finding it a bit more difficult now to hold on to their own position than they were in those times. But I don't say that we're all going to rise up tomorrow and deal with it, alas. I wish it were so.
I'll see a different scenario to the one that's some good points have been said about economic individualism and stuff like this. I mean, it seems to me that going away from the book for a moment. I don't know the book, to be honest, and it's not something, even though it was brilliantly presented. It's not a book that I would rush out and buy, because to me it just makes me even more depressed about capitalism than I already am. You know, I mean, I've reached a certain stage where I know these sort of things happen, you know, and it doesn't seem like it would exactly fill me with any energy and enthusiasm to sort of like get more involved than I already am in changing the world.
Anyway, I've told you the plot now.
You've told your plot now, yeah. But it seems to me that in terms of how we get from A to B, was what one of the people was saying, if we carry on the way we are, I can only see one development, and that is that it's not going to be anything to do with Socialist Party or other forces. It's going to be capitalism itself, which is actually going to fall apart, and that is going to actually bring any development. It's going to be a negative change, in other words, rather than a positive change. Now that's a contentious view, I realise that, but I can't see, realistically, any real difference ahead, unless we make systematic involvement, energy put into actually getting onto the media, because what we're really talking about is the battle of ideas. And you can hold as many meetings as you like, but you're not going to touch the type of numbers that we need to touch in order to really get any real change in society. And the only way you're going to do that is by getting onto the media. We've got to get onto the media. And if we ignore the media, if we carry on in the old traditional ways of old meetings, and I'm not in any way degrading what's happening here, I've come along myself because I'm interested and it's an important aspect of what we're doing. But we've got to pay attention, it seems to me, of saying, where are we going to go and how are we going to get there? We've got to get there fast, because it seems to me it's a battle against time. Because the longer we allow capitalism to carry on, the more we're going to get pushed into a corner we're not going to be able to get out again. I'm talking about in a world situation here. You know, I'm not trying to over-dramatise that. I really think that all the signs point in that direction. Anyone that's sensible looks at the news and actually can see what's actually happening. You know, in terms of the environmental crisis, in terms of the lack of control governments really have over society. I mean, you know, we've got to look at that, and I'm going to find that out as a general kind of view.
Somebody say this is the last question. I think people are beginning to vote with their feet. Have a cup of tea.
Can I just say one thing about that?
Well, there's a couple more people.
Did you want to say something?
Not if you're rushing. I'm not rushing to go away. I really asked a simple question. It was supposed to be a discreet question for the speaker to the chair. Right. The man behind you, and then you. Yeah.
The movement shared has ever since 1920. You had recorded in 24 the 3 million votes. Ever since then, Sinclair and the Socialist, not our Socialist Party, but their Socialist Party, has never got more than 420,000 in any election since 1948. And the only time they actually beaten one of the candidates was in Arizona in 1936, when Alf Landon came third against Franklin Roosevelt in the district in Phoenix, the citizen of Arizona by Barry Morris Goldwater.
Isn't there supposed to be one member of the American House of Representatives who claims to be to be a socialist.
No, I think you got beaten by a Republican.
Got beaten, right? I'm not even sure whether the Socialist Party of America still exists, does it? But perhaps that's the next interesting thing.
No, I don't. I
only
think it's worthwhile discussion. I think the issue that was raised about what we're doing is relevant. I think that there are. I mean, obviously, I thought a great deal about this. I think we have to think a great deal about it if we're going to pronounce upon it. But there are three issues. The issue is what people actually think, what people think everyone else thinks, and then what they think about it. And I think they are key useful questions about authenticity. And that's what's actually changed. But I don't think the first one has changed very much. I don't think it's changed in the way that it's suggested in front of me. I don't think what most members of the working class, even in a wider sense, think about society has changed dramatically from the beginning of the century to now, and there is a danger of romanticising or indeed historical invention, which somehow suggests that there was this rapidly growing and energetic socialist movement at the beginning of the century, and then now it's dissipated and demoralised and so on. And that's not the case. What I think is the case is, in fact, that if anything, there was a much greater degree of economic individualism in America and the West at the beginning of the century than there is now. I mean, I thought most of America then was a country nothing by immigrants who were creating the population of the country. Who went there with an enormous degree of economic expectation, as is suggested in that particular novel, of course. Now that's not happening in America. The people who do come into America as immigrants don't expect an enormous amount. And those who are already there have falling expectations. That biggest crisis in the West at the moment is a crisis of falling expectations. People don't believe that better things are going to happen to them. So I don't think what people think has changed a lot. As for what people think, I think that has changed. Because at the beginning of the century, there was an assumption that some kind of progressive change, probably a linear historical development towards some sort of different society, was going to occur. That is, of course, met with an enormous amount of frustration and a sense of demoralization. Because we mustn't forget, Socialist Party of America, profoundly racist organization. I mean, these aren't mere points of detail over which we disagree. 2 years after the publication of that book, 1906, first Labour MPs going to the House of Commons. A story of utter betrayal of hope and working class confidence. 10 years after that, a revolution in Russia, so on and so forth. We know about these sort of sense of betrayal and demoralization. I think that the consequence of that has been that what we have at the moment is a society which is falling apart in terms of any kind of cultural cohesion in class terms. What Marx called the difference between a class in itself and a class for itself, that is to say, the working class actually being stamped upon and the working class having a recognition of it, that's fallen apart to some extent. But the working class was never a socialist working class. If it was, we wouldn't have a problem. The working class has always been imbued with conditioning for capitalism. The problem is that what we now have is a situation where most people don't know what everyone else thinks. Now, this leads to the point over there about the media. The media is, in fact, I mean, it's useful to think of what the term media means, because we overuse it, I think. But the media is actually a systematic process of mediation between the way that people think and communicate with one another what they think. And the media is a process of now very carefully institutionalized and psychologically well adapted manipulation of how thought spreads. And thought could spread much more easily, I would say, at the beginning of the century, through the printed word, which is more accessible, through public meetings, which are more easily organized, than they can now. The question about whether we can take on that force, I think it's not a question of, you know, with respect to Steve Dowsett was saying at the front, when he said, I can't see. Well, this is a problem. Whether or not you can see the change occurring or not can depend on all kinds of things. It depends on whether you're feeling depressed or whether you're feeling optimistic. Whether you find yourself in an historical moment where things are happening or where they're not happening. Whether
the news manipulators are creating a set of negative images for us, which they definitely are at the moment, making us feel more hopeless, or whether it's a series of more positive images, such as in the 1960s and early 70s, where there's no doubt they have inflated people's sense of the degree of control they had over their own lives and over social progress. The issue isn't whether we can see it or not. The issue is whether we have a practical, material strategy for interfering in a revolutionary fashion in this process of mediation. If we do, then we undertake that process, which we do have. We as a political party have a media policy that we're pursuing. If it's a good one, then it will be successful. If it's a bad one, then we should either adopt another one. If the task is hopeless, then I would agree. We couldn't defeat the media. And that's what we have to do. It's not a question of whether we feel optimistic or pessimistic, because that is simply a second stage issue of us thinking about what other people think. And in a sense, if we are thinking in a condition of deep depression and bleakness, which is what the late 20th century is like, then it is tempting for that to influence away the socialist thing. And therefore it doesn't surprise me that not only socialists, but the left in general and all kinds of progressive movements are at the moment deeply demoralised, hopeless, undergoing psychological disorientation, feeling miserable. Obviously a lot of people who threw their lot in with the so-called socialist third of the world are now feeling guilty, embarrassed, numbed by it. Those who didn't are feeling betrayed because they're being associated with it. Those people who have argued a positive view of human nature in the course of the 20th century are finding ourselves having to answer for the consequences of the decomposition of capitalism, with the murders and riots and mayhem that is going on around us. I only have to have a very, keep our nerve, hold a very scientific view of this, exactly in the same way they did at the beginning of the 20th century, when what they were telling workers was that the whole world was before you, it's all yours to take as long as you play the game of capitalism. Socialists have got to completely dissociate ourselves from that, have a revolutionary awareness of where the power lies, how to take on that power, and get on with doing it. And I actually think that debates about how we feel are redundant, because in the end, where we are at the moment is in a position where we will either have a continuation of capitalism or we have socialism. And we can't get socialism unless a majority of workers understand and want socialism. And they're not going to understand and want socialism without there being some role on the part of those who are existing as socialists now, interfering in the control over working class minds that capitalists have, and playing our part in having an influence of our own.
Is that your
question?
Yes.
Just one little thing in there to use an American expression. We were talking about American author, hang in there, as they would say. I'm thinking about this because I think situations don't have emotions. Human beings have emotions. I think, you know, to be honest, sometimes I think if I ever got a terminal disease, I'd go out and buy a gun and shoot somebody. You know, I recognise that that's just purely my emotions talking, and it's part of this, and maybe you could write a thesis on the clutching of straws. Because yeah. How many straws can one clutch at? And if there are the number of straws in a pot finite that you can clutch at? If there are, pretty soon you clutch them all. Maybe the media is part of the straws that one clutches at. And sooner or later, you clutch enough straws, there's no straws left to clutch at. And then you're faced with the reality of the situation, which I, you know, honestly, with the best will in the world, I can understand this, you know, emotional thing, but
no.
With the best will in the world, it does seem to me that situations don't have emotions. We people have emotions.
I'm sure everyone realises that people have emotions.
So, sounds like the, when they get to feeling old, they often shoot themselves.
Nothing wrong with emotion,
yeah.
That's what makes us human.
Sure.
Sounds like a good last question. Sorry,
People be in front of emotion.
If people are just going on emotion, I mean, you look at the world as it is, you see that there's problems. Well, it's not just being just looking at it and having emotion all the time. I mean, we've got scientific socialism, the scientific method, observation, accumulation of data, orderliness, analysis, and the solution. We've got all that, and once you apply the scientific method, although there are things to bring out emotions worldwide, people are dying, people are getting killed, that is the reason that you've gone onto the material side. And if people are going to be emotional all the time, this is where you get your irrationality. Because you read about these irrationalities in the newspaper all the time and tell you that the collection of these emotional things is another emotional activity without the proper analysis. And I think that we should stress that the material side and the scientific method of applied. I mean, the accumulation of data was done by Karl Marx. That's what makes it scientific socialism. And he went right through and got the solution.
Okay, the sounds. Yes, I think, have we got the last question, which is how many drawers are there to clutch at?
I'd like to start by saying I once tried to make love to my wife according to the principles of scientific socialism, and she asked for a divorce the next morning. However, of course, there's truth in all of that. I think that in a way, this thing about the spreading of thought, you see, in a way I can understand, for me, the things... Although I've been moved by films, by TV, that something about something comes on, you push a button, it goes away. There's something about a book like this that moves me and enrages me and challenges me, and I pick it up and face those challenges again. And that is something that's gone from our world. I think one of the things is that people don't read as much as they used to for obvious reasons. But I think that, of course, it's true, how we feel does affect how useful we are. Maurice Maeterlinck once says, everything in the world is raised or diminished according to how you are when you look at it. And I think, whatever else, and I don't feel bleak about the prognosis, I have moments of bleakness and greater than others. What I think we must do as socialists, we have one great task, and that is this: not to let happen to us as individuals, as socialists, what happened to, for a time, and almost fatally to Jurgis. We must face the opposition of capitalism with blades of steel and a stronger steel, but we must never allow the steel heel to shut out those things in our mind that make us what we are, human and strong and emotional and spirited. And because if we lose that is the greatest victory that capitalism will ever have.